Welcome to the STEM Sessions podcast. I am your host, Cody Colborn. So a goal here at the STEM Sessions is to talk about STEM in non-STEM settings. It's kind of a way to get a broader audience to listen to a STEM talk without being billed as a STEM talk. And on Saturday, March 1st, 2024, I did just that at the Wild Wild West Convention in Tucson, Arizona. The Wild Wild West Con is a steampunk convention. Now, I'd call it a small to medium-sized convention. I mean, the exhibitor floor could be thoroughly visited in about a half hour. And six rooms were dedicated to panels and talks. I'm not sure of the three-day attendance figure, but everyone there was extremely passionate. I really had no idea what to expect in terms of how many people would show up to listen to me blather, but I was sure those who did would be quite bored. But I was proven so very, very wrong. When I started the talk, there were about 25 to 30 people in the room, and at the end, there were closer to 50. And they were all interested and engaged. In fact, I only saw one person doze off. Now, I recorded the talk on my phone just for my own archival purposes, but I had such a good time, I figure I'd share it here. So thank you to the Wild Wild West Con for having me, and hopefully we'll do it again next year. This is the STEM Sessions Podcast, Episode 27, Great Rivalries in 19th Century Science. All righty, I think we'll get started. So thanks everybody for coming. When I pitched this idea, I had no idea what the reception was going to be like. So I got to say the 30 of you here or so is like 28 more than I thought there'd be. So wonderful. So my name's Cody Colborn, and I'm here to talk about the rivalries in 19th century science. Well, first of all, is everybody having a good con so far?
Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. My first time here. Anybody else's first time? A couple newbies. Awesome. Awesome. Okay. So the first thing to keep in mind is the landscape and mechanics of scientific research in the 1800s was very different than it is today. Today, you can open up a scientific journal, look at it, pick any paper, and you might have 10 to 20 authors listed. And that's because authorship and credit is kind of today's currency. Universities and research institutions get bragging rights if they can say they have more published authors than their competitors. It also helps with things like grant proposals and issues like that. But back in the 1800s, scientific research was very much an individual undertaking. And while we have more public money going into research today, back then it was most often private. And returns on that investment was a priority. Also, for the individual scientist or researcher or engineer, back then, aside from teaching, making a name for yourself and securing patents was really the way you made a living going forward. Now, we also have to keep in mind that the history of science, just like the history of really anything, is malleable, and our interpretation of events and people tend to change as our societal norms change. So we view scientists and engineers and their actions of previous centuries through kind of whatever colored glasses we're looking through today. So for example, if you were in school, say in the 80s or earlier, that's the 1980s, not the 1880s, you were probably taught that Thomas Edison was the archetypal American inventor. In fact, there's a Simpsons episode called The Wizard of Evergreen Terrace, I think, in which Homer was inspired by this genius that is Edison, and he quit his job at the power plant to become an inventor. But then, within the last couple of decades, not so coincidentally with the rise of the internet, we've had a lot of revisionist historians / edgelords that come in and now are claiming that Edison was a total fraud, that he stole every idea that he was given credit for, and that Nikola Tesla was the real genius, and he was victimized by Edison's corporate greed. And interestingly, The Simpsons kind of covered that too, because Homer broke into the Edison Museum and to destroy it, but then was
got compassion and inadvertently left his electric mechanical hammer, which the museum curators then found and assumed it was an unfound Edison invention, and then all the royalties went to the Edison heirs. So it's kind of a it's cute how they did it. And as we know, if it shows up in The Simpsons, it's definitely relevant culturally, at least for those first 10 seasons or so. Now, I'm going to try to get back to Edison and Tesla at the end, but the majority of this talk is going to be spent on two different rivalries. The first is a rivalry I'm guessing a lot of you haven't heard of before, but it's fairly crazy what went on. And then the second rivalry is one that you probably know cursory information about, but didn't actually know that there is a rivalry and conspiracy behind everything. Also, I'm not going to try to take the full hour this time. I'm not sure my voice is going to be able to hold up. I want there to be time at the end for questions and then also enough time for you guys to get to whatever you're going to do after this. Also, just one quick piece of warning. There are going to be moments of audience participation. So when the time comes, I just want, you know, the best like whooping and a hollering for the questions I pose. And then we'll all be ready. Okay, so let's get into it. So the first dinosaur fossils were scientifically described in 1824 by William Buckland in Great Britain. Now, I say, you know, the clarification there is scientifically described because, of course, fossils have been found for centuries. But 1824 is the first time when a fossil was recorded scientifically as a big extinct animal. Over in the U.S., the first dinosaur fossils weren't cataloged until somewhere in the mid-1850s, and that was done by Joseph Leidy and Ferdinand Van Devere Hayden. He did the actual digging. Leidy did the cataloging. And those specimens were found in the Upper Missouri River region of Montana, not too far from where I grew up, incidentally. But it wasn't until the 1870s that the fossil area of study really kicked off, and that was when two young American paleontologists started trying to outdo each other at every turn. So this is really a tale as old as time. It's two men from different socioeconomic upbringings. They became good friends as young adults, were tight colleagues during their education, and then turned on each other in the pursuit of fame and money. And so I'd like to welcome everybody to the great Bone Wars of the 19th century. The first competitor in this war was Edward Drinker Cope. He was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania in 1840. Now, he was a child of high society, and as a child, his parents took him to the top museums, zoos, and public gardens of the day. His parents expected him to grow up and become a gentleman farmer, taking over the family property and their holdings. But his scientific interest and his proclivity in science eventually convinced his father that maybe a career in academia was more up his alley. So family money paid his way into the University of Pennsylvania, where he studied under the aforementioned Joseph Leidy, who was the most influential paleontologist at the time. Cope then toured Europe, where he rubbed elbows with all the high society scientists of France and Germany and Italy and Austria and Britain. It was a full European tour that family money paid for. After returning to the U.S., he was asked to serve as professor of zoology at Haverford College. Unfortunately, a professorship required a master's degree, which Cope did not have. He didn't even have a bachelor's degree at the time. But some creative thinking and a honorary master's degree from the college allowed him to take the position. Alas, teaching was not for him, and after a year, he quit and decided to travel the western U.S., the pioneer front, opening mines and digging for fossils. He served on many U.S. Geographical Survey teams. He was a member of the Academy of Natural Sciences and the American Philosophical Society. And while those organizations aren't that important today, back then, you made it as a scientist or an engineer if you were inducted into one of those organizations. Over the course of his career, he published 1,400 papers. though many of which were in journals he founded specifically to publish his papers, so take that as you will. But to his credit, he did discover, describe, and named over 1,000 vertebrate species, including one of the largest sauropods ever discovered. Now, his competitor in this rivalry was a man named Othniel Charles Marsh, and he was born in Lockport, New York, in 1831. He was a child of modest upbringing. His father was an actual farmer as opposed to a gentleman farmer. But he earned the Berkeley scholarship to attend Yale, where he studied geology, mineralogy, and chemistry. He then spent time studying and teaching in several universities in Germany, specifically in Berlin. And then he returned to the United States to become the professor of paleontology at Yale, which was the first official professorship of paleontology in the United States. In his career, he published roughly 400 scientific papers and discovered and described about 500 new species of fossils, including the first pterosaur in the U.S. What I think is even cooler is that his fossil finds bridge the gap between dinosaurs and birds. And we kind of tend to think that evolution from dinosaurs to birds is a more modern theory, but it dates all the way back to the 1870s. First started by Marsh. In fact, he contributed more physical evidence to Darwin's theory of evolution than any other scientist before him. And Darwin wrote later to Marsh, quote, "Your work on these old birds and on the many fossil animals of North America has afforded the best support to the theory of evolution which has appeared within the last 20 years." So I think that was that's a good credit to Marsh. In fact, even further, his personal collection of fossils is the backbone for the collections you see today at the Yale's Peabody Museum of Natural History and the Smithsonian Institution. He became president of the National Academy of Sciences and the official vertebrate paleontologist of the United States Geographical Survey. Now, these two men, Marsh and Cope, met in Berlin in 1863. Marsh was there teaching, and Cope was rubbing elbows with all of the rich and powerful scientists. By this time, Marsh already had 2 degrees, and Cope had none. But Cope had written 37 papers, of which I don't know how many were self-published, but we'll just say 37. And Marsh had only published 2. But they hit it off, and Marsh was actually Cope's tour guide for the several days he was in the city. And even after Cope left, they maintained a lot of correspondence, writing each other letters, trading fossils and photographs with each other, and even asking each other to proofread drafts of papers that they intended to publish. And this friendship and personal respect was so strong that Cope named a fossil after Marsh, the Colosteus marshi, and Marsh returned the favor by naming a fossil after Cope, the Mosasaurus copaeanus. And I'm sure my pronunciation of all those names were horrible, but we'll go with it. So as young men, they had this friendship and professional respect for each other. And then things turned sour. First blood was drawn in 1870 when Marsh visited Cope at a fossil quarry in New Jersey. Now, Cope had been pulling fossils out of this quarry for years, and if he wasn't doing it personally, the owners of the quarry would send any fossil finds to Cope for study. I suspect the tour that Cope gave Marsh of the quarry was somewhat informative, maybe more than a bit boastful, kind of showing all the cool things that he had found. He introduced Marsh to his team, showed him all the new equipment they were using, all the cutting-edge techniques they had been developing. He also introduced Marsh to the owners of the quarry. So after the tour was over and Cope went back to work, Marsh was walking out, and he decided to make a detour and go tag up with the owners again, in which he bribed them to send all future fossils to him instead of Cope. Yeah. But don't worry, Cope returned the favor several years later by wrestling fossils from sites in Kansas and Wyoming that Marsh believed was his territory. Then Marsh publicly humiliated Cope by pointing out that Cope had put the skull of a plesiosaur on the skeleton's neck instead of, or on the skeleton's tail instead of the neck. They bribed each other's teams, tried to influence each other's financial backers. They hired spies to keep track of each other to find out where they're digging next. What are they moving to? What are they pulling out of the ground? What's the next paper being published? And they used dynamite and other means to sabotage each other's dig sites. And more crazily, they would use dynamite to sabotage their own dig sites when they left so the other one couldn't come in and continue digging.
So totally ruining the fossils that might
Yes, be exactly, correct. Now, all that said, both men made significant contributions to the field of paleontology. In fact, they helped define the field of paleontology. Cope discovered 56 new dinosaur species, and Marsh discovered 80. And before their work started, only 9 species had ever been found in North America. So they were the catalyst for everything. And not only that, but they made dinosaur fossils synonymous with museums by basically starting the fossil trade, where museums then competed with each other to buy fossils to put on display. Without these two guys in the Bone Wars, dinosaur skeletons would not be the big centerpieces they are in museums and private collections. Unfortunately, the rivalry also had some negative impacts to the field of paleontology. They completely tarnished the international opinion of paleontology in the United States, and that even spilled over into other areas of science within the United States. Those sophisticated European scholars just found kind of their cowboy approach to collecting fossils a bit distasteful. And that reputation wasn't really repaired until the early 1900s. So for nearly 2 decades, Marsh and Cope attacked each other in newspapers and journals and public speeches. And their rivalry went all across the country, from New Jersey to Illinois and Kansas, Wyoming, Colorado, South Dakota. They used the USGS as their own kind of personal instrument to get to all the new dig sites and find fossils. And that also leads to a tangent of the real gross corruption that was in the USGS at the time, but that's a whole other talk that we don't have to, but look it up if you're interested. It's quite fascinating. But in the end, both men were basically broke and in poor health. But upon his death in 1897, Cope issued the final challenge. He donated his skull to science and challenged Marsh to do the same. He was hoping that he would show the world that his brain was larger and thus he was the smarter man compared to Marsh. Marsh died 2 years later and did not accept the challenge. So how many of you had heard of the Bone Wars before? Excellent. So it's if you want further reading, there's a lot of great books and a great documentary on it, but honestly, the Wikipedia entry is fantastic. I was reading through that thing for 3 or 4 days because it just goes deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And this is honestly just a quick summary. Some of the specific things they did are just ridiculous and crazy. So if you want to know more, go check that out. And even though Marsh and Cope were the two main characters in this war, there are a lot of other people involved. I mean, it was huge business, the amount of money that was being spent on fossils and finding them. In fact, the head of the USGS at the time, Powell, who, you know, Lake Powell is named after, was just as corrupt. And he would use both of them. They would use him. And it's just all kinds of crazy. So based on everything I just said, and because the theme of this convention is heroes and villains, we're going to take a little vote here. Who thinks Cope was the hero? Good answer. Who thinks Marsh was the hero? Okay. My opinion, they're both pretty bad people. And I would say they're both villains. But yeah. Correct. Yeah, absolutely. It still happens. It's just
not
as dastardly, not as damaging, physically damaging. But yeah, it's still, credit is still a big deal. People are still, because grant money is involved, and it's still, and then it even turned into personal collections as well, with the debate between someone going out and buying a great specimen when that should be in a museum to be studied by other people. So it's messy, but yeah, that was the kind of the peak of it, and then it stretched on for a long time. So any questions before we go to the second of our rivalries we want to talk about? Okay. Take a drink. Okay, so we're going to go back to 1844. This is when Samuel Morse sent a message from Washington, D.C. To Baltimore, Maryland, a distance of approximately 50 miles. The message read, "What hath God wrought?" And he did so, of course, not by letter or carrier pigeon, but by telegraph, which was a relatively new technology at the time for transmitting information electronically. And much like the internet today, this original email set off a technology boom. Research and development into communication and electronics exploded. It was the big money maker of the time. Now, initially, a telegraph was limited to one message on the wire at a time. You had a transmitter at one end, a receiver at the other end, and they were only looking for one electrical impulse on that wire. They were in tune with each other. And you can imagine that this was a very costly and slow process to have to only send one message at a time and make sure it was heard on the other end. You would get a receipt. And there was always a lot of corruption in the message itself. So there's certainly room for improvement. So in the 1870s, the holy grail of telegraph technology was the acoustic or harmonic telegraphy. And this was a means of sending and receiving multiple messages on a single wire at the same time, by encoding each of the messages on a unique frequency. Very similar to what we do with a radio receiver today. You just tune into the frequency you want, and you get the signal comes out. And there are a few ways you could do this. You could have multiple transmitters on one end of the wire tied in with multiple receivers on one end of the wire, or you could have the goal was to have a single box that you could change the frequency on and send your message. So multiple people started researching the technology. Among them were Elijah Gray and Alexander Graham Bell are the two people we're going to talk about. Now, this would eventually turn into the telephone. But it also turned into years of lawsuits and decades of conspiracy theories. So we'll start with Alexander Graham Bell, the more famous of the two. He was born in 1847 in Edinburgh, Scotland, and he had an early interest in both natural sciences and engineering, as well as art, poetry, and music. In fact, at age 12, he invented a dehusking machine for his neighbor's grain mill. Now, during his childhood, his mother developed increasing deafness, and that led him to an interest in the science of acoustics. He briefly attended the University of Edinburgh and the University College in London. He even was an instructor at Somerset College. However, in 1870, he and his parents moved to Ontario, Canada, after both of his brothers sadly died and Alexander Graham Bell himself had taken ill. But even then, he continued working with electricity and sound. While in Canada, he learned the Mohawk language and translated it into the visible speech system, which was kind of the precursor to American Sign Language. And for his effort, the Mohawk people gave him the title of honorary chief. In 1871, he moved to Boston to introduce this visible speech system to the many deaf schools in Boston. And in 1872, he even opened his own deaf school called the School of Vocal Physiology and Mechanics of Speech in Boston. In fact, one of his students was Helen Keller. Alexander Graham Bell held 30 patents during his lifetime, including an early version of a metal detector. He also invented a wireless telephone that he called the photophone. And this is voice wireless, before voice was even going over radio waves. And he called that his greatest invention. And in many ways, it was the precursor to our fiber optics today. He also invented the aileron for the newfangled flying machines of the day to give them stability in the air. In 1877, he became a fellow in the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. In 1882, he was inducted into the American Philosophical Society. And he also served as the president of the American Institute of Electrical Engineers. All right, so let's move on to Elijah Gray. He was born in Barnesville, Ohio in 1835. He grew up on a farm and then attended Oberlin College, where he taught sciences and engineering classes. He also maintained the science and engineering labs and built equipment for the science and engineering labs. And while he technically did not graduate, he went on to be a very successful electrical engineer. In 1869, he founded Gray and Barton, and they supplied telegraph equipment to Western Union. In 1871, Gray and Barton was hired to rebuild the Chicago telegraph system after it had earlier burned to the ground. In 1872, Western Union bought Gray and Barton, renamed it the Western Electric Manufacturing Company, and it became the official R&D division of Western Union, with Gray serving as the chief engineer. Now, in 1874, he retired from his day-to-day administrative duties at Western Electric, but continued to invent for them. In his career, he held 70 patents, including a patent for the electric telegraph for transmitting musical tones with a keyboard. And this is actually one of the earliest musical instruments ever invented, and you could probably say that he was the great, 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 great grandfather of the synthesizer and other electronic instruments. He also had a patent for the teleautograph, which is an ancestor to the fax machine. And this was actually the first fax where the stylus that did the writing could be controlled in both the X and Y axis. In 1878, he was inducted as a member of the American Philosophical Society. So we'll go back a little bit to the early 1870s, and now both Gray and Bell, as well as a couple others, are attempting to develop that acoustic or harmonic telegraph that we had just discussed. On February 11th, 1876, Elijah Gray included a diagram of a telephone in his notebook for the first time. On February 14th, 1876, so 3 days later, Gray filed a caveat with the U.S. Patent Office for a telephone design that used a water transmitter. Now, a bit of clarification, a patent caveat is not a full application. It's basically official notice to the Patent Office that you'll be filing a full application in the very near future. It's basically a way to get your foot in the door. And for many reasons that we will discover later, this is a process that is no longer allowed by the Patent Office. Also on February 14th, Bell's lawyer followed Bell's full patent application for the telephone with the U.S. Patent Office. On February 19th, the Patent Office put a suspension on Bell's application to allow Gray time to submit his full application, at which point the Patent Office would determine who developed the idea first. And these investigations often involved very, very public hearings. On March 7th, 1876, the Patent Office awarded Alexander Graham Bell patent number 174465 for the, quote, method of and apparatus for transmitting vocal or other sounds telegraphically by causing electric undulations similar in form to the vibrations of the air accompanying the said vocal or other sound, unquote. On March 8th, Bell recorded an experiment in his lab notebook that included a diagram of a telephone similar to that shown in Gray's patent caveat. On March 10th, Bell successfully got his prototype to work using a liquid transmitter, sending a voice message from a room in one side of his building to a room on the other. And now, simply put, before we go on, a liquid transmitter operated thusly. The user would speak into a diaphragm, and that diaphragm would vibrate. Those vibrations would cause a needle that was hooked up to the electric circuit to vibrate in water, and those vibrations resulted in changing electric resistance, which is what you could tune to different frequencies to send multiple messages at the same time on a wire. Now, for those interested, in case you, this is kind of well known, that message from one side of the building to the other was from Bell to his assistant, and it said, "Mr. Watson, come here. I want to see you." Okay, so let's recap. Bell was granted the patent for the telephone and got his prototype to work only after using the water transmitter found in Gray's caveat. Seems a bit suspicious, right? Well, Gray and his lawyers and many of their contemporaries thought so too. And because of that, conspiracy theories and patent challenges abounded. Now, during these hearings, the patent examiner in charge of both Bell's application and Gray's caveat stated in his affidavit that he was an alcoholic indebted to Bell's lawyer because of some help Bell's lawyer gave him during the Civil War. And he claimed that he showed Bell Gray's patent caveat after Bell paid him $100. Now, in today's money, that's like $2,300 ish. So a good bribe, not the highest I've seen, but a good one. Now, in his defense, in his affidavit, Bell denied ever giving the patent examiner any money and claimed that they discussed the patent caveat only in general terms. That said, there was a letter written shortly thereafter from Bell to Gray in which Bell kind of admitted that he learned some of the technical details from Gray's caveat. Now, even though the patent was awarded, in 1876, the legal shenanigans lasted until the 1890s. And in fact, in January 13th, 1887, the U.S. government stepped in and tried to annul the telephone patent on the grounds of fraud. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court. Bell eventually won, but it took 9 years, and by that time, the patent had expired. Now, I suspect this was due more to the government not wanting Bell and his company to have royalties and exclusivities on the hardware, more so than an honest challenge on intellectual principles. So the theory that Alexander Graham Bell stole the idea of the telephone from Elijah Gray rests on the perceived similarity between the liquid transmitter used in Bell's prototype with that shown in Gray's patent caveat. But there is extensive evidence that Bell had been using liquid transmitters for years at that point in his experiments. In 1875, he was granted a patent for another form of a fax machine, which included multiple liquid transmitters, and that was 10 months before the caveat and his telephone patent application were filed. His notebooks were also filled with descriptions of variable resistant devices that use mercury instead of water. So this was not a new piece of technology that Gray thought of in a bubble. Further, Bell filed his telephone patent in Great Britain the year earlier in 1875 because Britain at the time would not grant patents to technology that had already been patented elsewhere. So it was a money play. You get it patented in Great Britain to secure the rights there, and then you file in the U.S. to secure the rights in the U.S. and you're doubling up your rewards. He also notarized his patent application on January 20th, a good month before submitting it to the patent office. And after learning these two facts, Gray actually ended up dropping his challenge to Bell's priority on the patent. When you really look at the prototypes developed, the liquid transmitter used in Bell's prototype phone is not at all like the liquid transmitter described in Gray's caveat. It was built to the specifications in his own patent application, and the big difference was namely the type and number and positioning of the electrodes between them, and that makes a big difference to the overall circuit technology and behavior, even though the output is the same. So today, patents are basically awarded to the first person to file the application, and that's the end of the story. But as you saw in the past, competing patent applications were often decided by who had the idea first, and to determine that, documentation such as dated letters, dated notebooks, dated drawings all came into play. It was a very messy process, and that's most likely why today it's a first to file decision, period. Also, what I find most comical about this story is really only a handful of people in the United States at the time were actively working on this acoustic telegraphy. And per letters and documents between those people and to other people that survive today, this small group of researchers was quite gossipy. Everybody seemed to talk behind everybody else's back. Person A would tell person B not to trust person C, and at the same time, person C would tell person A not to trust person B. So everybody was trying to hide their notebooks from each other. They built desks with false bottoms and drawers to hide things. But at the same time, their letters showed that they also couldn't help boasting to each other about whatever new idea they came up with or what new advancement they had just developed. It was definitely a way of kind of needling or ribbing the competition, so to speak. They couldn't help themselves. And I suspect they all knew, like the four or five of them, all knew what the other four or five were working on in great detail. And so these challenges were more about ego than actual, oh, you stole my idea, because they were all stealing from each other. Now, here's the thing. All of that information was known then. This isn't a new discovery. It was all documented during the lawsuits. But much like today, even back then, a good conspiracy theory never dies, and that's why it's continued on. So I suspect pretty much everyone in here knows that Alexander Graham Bell got credited for inventing the telephone. But just for my own curiosity, did anybody know about the Elijah Gray side of the story? No. And did anyone know it got as messy as it did, or just that he was also an inventor? Okay. So again, there's a lot of good books and some documentaries on YouTube about it. A lot of them get kind of fanciful. But again, Wikipedia scores a point. I mean, if you just want to read it, it does a great job with both men. So, just like we did before, who thinks Bell was the hero? Okay. Who thinks Marsh was the hero? Yeah, that's pretty much it. It was more or less a gray area. They definitely weren't villains. I don't think they were necessarily heroes either. I think it was just some people that got swept up in the process in a already very messy process. And then once they had settled things, it was other people that started coming out of the woodwork to delay it further. Yes?
So I had a question about, because you said that Gray only filed like a patent application for something that said that he would.
Yeah, a caveat.
And so did any of his prototypes actually work when he was arguing so vehemently?
No. So that was another thing is before then, he had tried to develop he had a prototype that he tried to demonstrate to his church like the year before. And using a liquid transmitter of sorts, and it didn't work. And according to his notebooks, that prototype, he basically abandoned it and moved on to doing, kind of tweaking it into other iterations. But he didn't record any other experiments after that one. Interestingly, though, Bell didn't really have any experiments in his book until after he got the patent either. He had kind of early technology experiments, but nothing that was really demonstrated fully by the patent application.
So he got the patent first and
then? Yes. So at the time, the patent office did not require any type of prototype work or any type of experiment. It could be solely a paper project. And if you look at some of those old patent applications, the amount of detail and science in many of those patent applications was highly variable from one to the next. You kind of get the feeling that there was a bit of politicking going on in the patent office and with people submitting. So it was messy. But yeah, and that's why I also say it's very much a gray area, and that they all were well aware of what each other was working on, and it's kind of like what we see today. You know, there is no longer really a singular aha moment. A lot of this technology is converging from a lot of different sources, being worked at the same time. Nothing's done in a vacuum anymore, and that's true even back then. So, yeah, it's just it really just depends on how history records the events and what their popularity becomes. Yeah. Any other questions? Yes.
Wasn't Bell also involved in some stuff with Edison and a few other things?
Oh yeah. So Edison was one of the other guys that I talked about working on acoustic telegraphy. And I think there was one or two other people. It was the three of them and one or two other people. But Edison, he basically had too many things going on. You know, so that's why he didn't pursue it. But yeah, there is some possible shenanigans between everybody, between Bell and Edison. Though from what, I didn't get too deep into it in the research, but it did seem like there was possibly some handshaking and then some bad blood between them and, you know, just more of the same, basically. Yeah. You got a question?
Well, I just wanted to change the scenario a little bit and look at biological sciences, because I'm thinking of, you know, vaccines, salt, and, you know, the polio vaccines. And there were two competing ones,
yep.
And one won over the other because it was easier to administer and more effective. But then also DNA, Watson and Crick, and I'm not seeing the same competition in the biological sciences, at least in the 50s and 60s, that you're describing much earlier with you know, early 1900s technology.
So I suspect, when it came to, say, like all the vaccine research, a lot of that work was done out of reputable institutions, for lack of a better term, right? And yeah, exactly. But all of this work was being done out of garages, you know? And so I suspect that there was just a lot more gung-ho, no holds barred, you know, free for all going on. And also, you know, it may also be that financial models changed. Like, these guys were doing it to make money. And with the vaccine effort, you know, I don't want to, you know, there's probably some, maybe a larger amount of altruism in the vaccine effort, a little bit, but it's still a business. But I think because there were like institutional reputations involved, maybe it just didn't quite get as nasty.
But then, okay, a different example. Apple was kind of being developed in garages, mm-hmm. Wozniak and yep. Jobs. And of course, Microsoft was doing their thing and they yep. came out about the same time. So those kinds of competitions are still going on.
Oh yeah. I mean, read about the history of the mouse. I mean, that's who came up with it? Did HP come up with it? Did Packard Bell come up with it? There's a lot of competing notes about who developed it first and who might have seen what at the time. So there's the early internet and early computer, there is a high level of this stuff going on too. So maybe it is just like what was being done as individuals, and you know, didn't really have like the institutional backing behind it, and that might have just kept things more calm. I don't know. The more you read about it, the more fascinating these kind of the hidden stories are. And on one hand, I understand why they don't. That's not what gets taught, because it is getting very much into the weeds about things. But I think that, you know, part of me thinks maybe if it was taught more, there'd be more people interested in it, and it would just, you know, who knows? Yeah.
So I want to give you time to do Tesla too, because I'm still interested in that story.
Right. So let me see. Yeah, we can talk about it for a little bit. So I don't have full notes for it, so this will be a bit more off the cuff. But so Edison, of course, as we know, has a whole mess of patents. And not only did he have a whole mess of patents, but he also had a lot of money and also employed a lot of people. And Tesla was one of those people that he employed. And of course, there was, you can really get into their relationship about, was it a true employee-boss relationship, or was there any, did it kind of go into abusive relationship? And it kind of seemed like it did, at least temporarily, which is why, you know, Tesla ended up quitting and moving to Colorado just to kind of get away from everything. But what I, from a legal standpoint, what I find very fascinating about that story, is the difference between, it is very, from the documentation, it is very apparent that Edison did not develop all of the ideas that he has patents for. It's just crystal clear on a lot of them. And so the knee-jerk reaction is that, well, he stole all the ideas. If other people came up with them, then he stole it. And again, this is a point of kind of looking at things back then versus with our own modern ethics, in a way, or our own modern business ethics. Because I think an argument could be made that in Tesla and other engineers and inventors that were under Edison's employ were under a work-for-hire contract. And therefore, Edison or his company as the employer, those inventions become his property, and it's his right to file the patent.
A lot of companies now have that.
Exactly. I mean, I work for a company that has it, and we get our name would appear on the patent if it were ever to be filed, but we see no royalties from it, right? So we might as well, it's just bragging rights at that point. But contract law at the time was not as crystal clear as it is today. And I don't think we really had those concepts versus freelance versus work for hire versus, you know, gig employee or whatever we call it today. And in my opinion, that's where a lot of it gets murky and muddy is, But also, if you look at it all in that vein, it's Edison and his company's technology, because they were paid to develop it, and then he got it, you know. But I think the switch in Edison becoming the bad guy in the story is really just kind of a sign of the times when, you know, that really started kind of coming out of like the grunge era when all that happened. And so there's a lot of a new wave of dissension of young people. Like, I'm that generation. So yeah, we were all edgy and, you know, trying to like bring, you know, like, oh, this institutional stuff is BS, like blah, blah, blah. And then of course, you get into your mid-40s, and it's like, oh, yeah, okay, I get it. So, and I think that combined with the internet and that generation now having a way of kind of publishing their voice to a wider audience is really what caused that Edison's bad, Tesla, or Tesla's the real genius. I mean, and don't get me wrong, they're both geniuses, or they were, genius might be a wrong word. They were both highly successful and incredibly intelligent engineers and inventors. But getting back to Tesla, what I find kind of comical about people who say, oh my, you know, Tesla's this genius, he was revolutionary. Well, sort of. I mean, you also look at some of the ideas he was working on, and this stuff would even work in science fiction. It goes against the laws of physics in many ways, as we know it. He wasn't ahead of his time in a lot of that stuff. You know, like people keep trying to bring up Tesla was transmitting power through the air back in the 1800s. And it's like, no, he wasn't. And we're never going to get to that point because it's very dangerous to transfer power through the air. You know, it's like, well, you could transfer it through the ground. That's what he was doing. It's like, yeah, but it doesn't work like that. So there's also a big misunderstanding of what Tesla was working on because it was so fantastical and ahead of its time. It's very easy to then say that people like Edison kept him down and kept him from working and.
So when he broke away from Edison's company, did he file any patents when he moved to?
So he did. Unfortunately, money was an issue. Mm-hmm. And filing patents takes money. Mm-hmm. And so there are other stories where he would get people to financially back him so he could file patents. And then they would take the royalties or whatever deal they came up with for that return on the investment. But yeah, from what I've read, Tesla in the later years, when he was doing a lot of his bigger projects, had a lot of financial issues. And that kind of, that I think kept a lot of his ideas from being published. And, you know, I'll also say there's definitely evidence or hints of other of this is people basically saying, like, Tesla's a hoax, don't listen to him, look at our stuff instead. Because
But he also, like I said, committed fraud.
Absolutely.
He would get people to invest in something.
Yep.
And then he could take the money and go off and do something
else. Exactly. But he wasn't the only one doing that either. But yes.
Nobody's
yeah.
Clean
correct.
Clean.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, I want to say that Tesla was right now doing the transfer of power in the air. It just wasn't to the extent he thought it.
Correct.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
It's all transmitted power.
Yep.
Through the air.
Yeah, but just not halfway around the world at, you know, thousands of amps and that he wanted. You know, that's dangerous. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, RFID, yeah, that's definitely that. Yes.
I think part of the reaction is that as kids we were spoon fed the Disney version
yep.
of history. Where this is good, this is bad, this is whatever, and then you get to college or whatever, and you actually, oh, hey, this guy was actually, you know, this or this, or whoever it was, you know, from Jefferson to Tesla, you know, there's always a dark side of these people
yep.
that you're not taught, you know, in the Schoolhouse Rock version of things that we grow up with, and it's kind of an eye-opening experience at the time. You go, wait, what is it? They're gone, what?
Yeah. I think that's a big part of it. And what you, like you say, with the internet now, I mean, you can access Wikipedia, this, that, and the thing instantly. You can actually see other points of view that maybe you were never exposed to.
Yeah, and I think the lesson really is there were no good old days. People's ethics and business ethics and morals were just as gray as they are today. I mean, people are people are people are people. And, what goes on today, there's some, something similar went on a century ago and two centuries ago. And you're absolutely right. You know, there's always a simplified version of history that gets taught. And it's almost like the rubber band gets stretched in this direction and becomes more and more saccharine. And then someone comes along and says, oh my God, that's not what happened. And then they stretch the rubber band in the other direction and completely flip the script.
That's why I get so upset. It's called revisionist. No, it's actually
clarifying. Yeah.
There's a lot of misinformation that goes into making these heroes or whatever for whatever reason. And the winner writes the history.
Right.
So Edison won, Tesla lost. So the Edison story goes on, you know, a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad from that growing up all thought he was, you know, the greatest thing in sliced bread. But maybe he was, maybe he wasn't.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think the danger, is going too far in the other direction with the facts or the interpretation of the facts. And it's really just like everybody get used to shades of gray, because that's pretty much what history is. You know, that's where we're at. Any other questions? Yes.
What made you start with
the Okay, so, well, I'll just kind of go on to this part then. So we, many years ago, I started a group called, in Southern California, called the STEM Sessions. And it was basically a way for basically creating opportunities for adults to share their knowledge of STEM with each other outside of the classroom or Caltech lecture series or things like that. 'Cause what I found is that there are a lot of smart people out there who work in any number of industries, who have studied any number of math topics or engineering topics, and waiting for, you know, trying to drive to, I'll just use the Caltech series again, trying to drive up to Caltech for a 5 p.m. lecture on a Wednesday in L.A. does not work unless you're already up there. So I said, well, why can't we tap into this experience of kind of the normal people who have an interest in STEM? So I created the STEM Sessions, and right now we're running meetups in the Southern California area. There's also, we're also doing a podcast.
Where in Southern California?
LA, Long Beach areas. Everything's kind of centered in Long Beach because that's where everybody can get to.
I live in San Diego. Long Beach is exactly.
So we are looking to expand to other areas now. But one of the other things that I decided early on that would be cool is, the podcast is great, and it's focused more on just kind of like, the podcast is basically if one of us in the group needed to answer a question or stumbled upon a topic that they wanted to research, we would turn that into an episode, because it's fear like, well, if I find it interesting, then probably a lot of other people are going to find it interesting too. So it's a lot of that stuff. It's a lot of like backyard science, and it's all geared towards, it's kind of like a 101 level discussion with like one more deeper level into it. But the other thing that we've started doing are, you know, talks like these where we do kind of a STEM related talk in a non or a more of a non-STEM setting, like Renaissance fairs or pirate invasions, and things like conventions like this. Like Well, San Diego, we're trying to do one at the Tiki Oasis, the big Tiki Oasis convention. So we've also done things like just going out onto a public street and setting up with a big flip board of a PowerPoint presentation and giving like a mini lecture on the street. We just figured that, you know, if people can go out and play guitar or pass out like religious or other organizational pamphlets, we can go out and talk about some random subject in science or engineering. And it's been fun. And so for this particular topic, I'm from Phoenix, so I wanted to come out here. And it was, I said, okay, we know it's like, steampunk, so I knew the time period. And then when they said heroes and villains, it was just like it clicked. Oh, yeah, well, let's do rivalries in science. And that's how I got here. So, yeah. So look us up online if you're interested. Like I said, we're trying to expand to other areas. The STEM sessions. Yeah. And I also have stickers if anybody wants them with our new logo on it. So, so that's basically all I had. If there are no other questions, then I definitely, yes?
So I know that there are a lot of things that are considered like really sad or horrible events that happened that have vastly expanded knowledge in scientific areas, like the Holocaust is a really horrible event that should not have happened, but it vastly expanded medical knowledge because of all the experimentation that happened. So would you consider these kinds of like spats, specifically between Edison and Tesla, because that one got really messy, to be something like that for a technological event?
I don't know if I would go that far because I kind of see disagreements and arguments between individuals as more their business. And, you know, it's just kind of like, I see it as, okay, these are people who are both in the game and they're doing what they need to get ahead. And yeah, like they all kind of have some questionable ethics going on there, but then with the World War II stuff, that's way more like on an institutional scale.
Right.
And, you know, and whether it's medical or even, you know, rocket technology, you know, space technology, I think you can simultaneously denounce the event, but also be accepting of any technology that comes out of it. Because if you also denounce the technology, then that really horrible stuff was just horrible stuff. And it's like, it's a weird, you know, weighting system. And I don't, you know, I'm definitely not a philosopher and ethics scholar, so it's hard for me to say, but I just think it, you know, it is possible to exist in a gray area when you can denounce one thing but still eventually be okay with what kind of came out of it, you know, because you just have to separate it, you know. It's So anyway, thanks everybody for coming and indulging me, and have a good rest of the convention. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the STEM Sessions podcast. It was researched, written, and produced by Cody Colborne. Show notes can be found at thestemsessions.com, and feedback and corrections are always welcome. If you received value from this episode and wish to give some back, please visit thestemsessions.com/value-for-value for ways to support the podcast. And please remember, STEM belongs to everyone. We should not allow it to be siloed or gatekept by experts, policymakers, or talking heads. Bias is found in every message, so always verify what you read and what you're told. Until the next episode, stay curious.